Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, council member in Bridgeport, Pennsylvania, which is nestled a little bit away from Philadelphia and close to Valley Forge and King of Prussia. So I am excited to have you here, as always, listening. I am getting close to my goal of having all 50 states represented on the podcast and a variety of different guests. And I hope everyone is safe right now during the quarantine. Like everyone, like so many others, I am in my home right now. And I am looking forward to this situation being handled and taken care of safely. And that's my goal. That's my hope. But, you know, a lot of it's over my pay grade, I guess. With that, not as great introduction to the podcast itself. I hope you'll go back and subscribe to listen to some recent episodes as well. I'm excited for today's episode with my second guest from Maine, but my second guest who's running for Senate. Her name is Tiffany Bond. She is running in the state of Maine, as I said, and there's an interesting discussion to be had here because Maine's elections are not like everyone else's elections. And as you'll hear from our discussion, the system in Maine is not necessarily a two-person race. It is not just about who gets the most votes. Things have changed there, and it's going to be a hot, hot contested race, not just because the summer's coming up, because of the election's in the fall, but for what it represents, for changing of the Senate, and maybe changing the way we do elections overall. And I think Tiffany's going to have a lot of really interesting and important things to say. So I hope you check out the whole episode. And I hope that you listen to past episodes as well and share this with your friends. So with that little bit in mind, Tiffany, thank you so much for taking time today from your home to my home to talk on a podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so you are in Maine and you are running for Senate. But as I ask all my guests, when did you first kind of pay attention to and get interested in politics?
Well, I've always been semi-engaged, but I never saw myself as somebody who would run for office. That was not a job I was not necessarily wanting. I am a family law attorney, so I work with a lot of law on a daily basis, both state and federal. In about 2017, there was a House rep in Maine that was voting for things that were making my job objectively harder, and I found that very frustrating. And I looked at the candidates at the time, and I think at the peak I was running it against about 11 men, which is sort of mathematically impossible, but there it was. And I just looked at the qualifications and their background, and I thought, oh my gosh, we have a whole bunch of people running that are probably running with the best of intentions, but they maybe don't have the skills necessary to fix the problems that I'm seeing. I think we need somebody who's on the receiving end of some of these laws to understand what they're doing to people. So I figured that I could at least put my name in the hat, and if folks wanted to consider me and be open to the possibility, that would be great.
Yeah, from talking with a lot of other people on this podcast, I hear that one of the reasons to have more representation and diversity in politics is that people, like the example you said, are making laws without being on the receiving end of them. So even if their intentions are good, it's hard to understand what the impact of those laws are going to be if you're writing something and you don't really get how it's going to impact poor people or women or gay people, like all these different groups that you don't really understand because you've never lived that life.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's simple things, like a lot of things sound really good but aren't. So, for example, work requirements on a food stamp. That sounds like a great idea. Like, if you are an able-bodied person, you should be trying to work if you want assistance. The problem is, disproportionately, there are a lot of people who are out of the workforce, and maybe they're caring for adult children that have disabilities. Maybe they themselves have an undiagnosed disability, and they don't have the health care necessary to get the diagnosis. Maybe there are just simply no jobs around, or they don't have transportation that's viable for a job. You know, I think a lot of people have the perception of, well, just take a bus. You know, rural Maine, just take a bus is not an option. If you don't have a vehicle, you can't get to work. Maybe there's child care issues and no subsidies or no child care available. So So a lot of the factors that we put in place for, you know, what would qualify for trying to work, it actually ends up disqualifying a lot of people, and a lot of people go hungry. And I don't think generally that's the intent of legislators that push for that. I think that they are trying to prevent fraud and be sensible, but they don't necessarily see that. And that's one example, but there are tens of thousands of examples throughout our legislation.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the COVID-19 issue right now, and Congress putting together stimulus plans for that, and there's a discussion of, should we give these checks to people who are making X number of dollars a year? Should it be different? And going back and forth. Of course, now is an emergency, but there's been a lot of pushback to that, saying people just need money. Just send them the money, and you can figure out the other issues later. It sounds like even with this, why make this more complicated when people legitimately need the money?
Well, the amounts of money that we're talking about, most rational people aren't willing to risk a fraud charge to try and get an extra $200 a month from the government, right? I mean, these are not large dollar scams people are running. And if there is a scam in place, it can be caught later, like you said. And a lot of the things that they put in place to make sure that people aren't abusing the system or only people who need it are getting it, often, A, you end up having gaping holes, and B, what you end up doing is spending more money trying to prevent fraud than the actual fraud prevented. So I don't know that those are really helpful. I mean, one of the things that has been a real problem with putting in place that cap that they put on the $1,200 stimulus checks, although I would not have actually been in favor of that. I do think a reoccurring payment is a much better mechanism, although that in and of itself is like a 45-minute long podcast discussion. But, you know, for example, I have multiple clients, and I don't have thousands of clients. I have about 60 active clients at any given point in time. I have multiple clients, and either all of their income is derived from rental properties or from owning a small business, and maybe they're above that threshold in 2018 or 2019, but they aren't now because they have no income. So you end up having huge holes for people when you put a lot of those things in place, and when you're in a critical position, we just shouldn't have those caveats or screeners.
So these are some reasons why you decided to be more attuned to what was going on in electoral politics in Maine. But this isn't 2017 or 2018. This is 2020. And now you are on the ballot. You are running for office against Susan Collins, the very unsure, furrow-browed senator from Maine, and as she's known across the country. Why did you decide that you're going to run, and why... This is the longer answer. Why did you decide to run in the way that you're running?
So, one quick correction. I'm not actually on ballot yet. We have some complications in Maine with ballot access. So, though our voting access is great, our ballot access for independents is fairly high here. And there are some things that are not necessarily party-driven, that are power-driven. Mm-hmm. And because the deadline for independents is substantially after the deadline for party candidates, there has been no action on behalf of the state to try to find ways for people to safely collect signatures for the ballot. So that's a challenge. I certainly would have made very different choices if we were before the party deadline. And just so you know, non-party candidates in Maine have to collect twice the signatures of party candidates to make the ballot. So it's an interesting system we have. We're still working on equality in that area. So as far as what got me interested in running, I did run against a House rep in 2018, and he lost. And he lost in part because of our very interesting voting system. So we don't have a first-past-the-post voting system. We have what's called ranked choice voting. So you rank on the ballot whomever you like in the order that you like. And in order to win, you have to get at least 50% of the votes in the round you're in. And if nobody gets 50% in the first round, what happens is the lowest ranking candidate or candidates are removed as an option, and there's an instant runoff with the ballots already cast. And that continues until somebody gets 50%. So your favorite candidate might not win, but somebody who's palatable to at least half of the people voting is the person who wins. So the race I was in actually was pretty close to a tie between a Democrat and a Republican, and it actually ended up being the second choice votes of my voters that determined the outcome of the race. So because of that, the person who was motivated me to run for office is no longer in office. They're not a problem for me anymore. But now Susan Collins is voting for things that are objectively making my job harder and not great for Maine. So I decided, look, I guess I could do this again. I developed a unique campaign style in 2018 that I wanted to try on a statewide race. I really love federal law. I would love to work with it in a different way. And a lot of the Senate confirmation hearings, which is something that the House doesn't do, those are very important to me as somebody who works in the courts, mm-hmm. watching judges who are not qualified get appointed. I mean, that is a level of terror for everybody in the courtroom. So I want to do what I can to prevent that. So you mentioned my unique campaign style. And what I did is in 2018, I thought, I don't want to run for the office the way we have been running for office. It is a horrible job interview. We are talking about things the way we want them to be, but we're not doing them. So I started looking at campaigns and how you make a campaign really reflect your values. So, for example, campaign signs, those lawn signs, are hundreds of thousands of dollars. They're very expensive. They are not good for the planet. They're disposable. They're used for a limited period of time. And I'm both frugal and I really care about the future of our planet. It is important to me that my children have a place that's habitable when they grow up. So I thought, well, how can I replace that in a way that's better for the planet, better for the budget, and better for everybody? And we came up with downloadable window signs. So there's 8.5 by 11 sheets, a whole bunch of different things, or make your own. And you can download them from the website and tape them in your car window or your home window. It acts as sort of a billboard. And then at the end of the season, you can just recycle it or start a campfire with it. We have a lot of camps here, so that's pretty popular choice. We have some videos of folks using their campaign signs to start their campfires and kind of start recycling it in a main way, I guess. So, we looked at what else can we do? I mean, that's a great way to cut out a huge chunk of cost. Like, what else do we hate? Well, I don't like money in politics. I fundamentally find it to be toxic. So I tried to come up with a way that I could still get a message out, but not touch it. So the campaign that I ran in 2018, I spent a little under $800 on running for federal office. I ended up getting 5.7% of the vote, and it ended up flipping the race, which was fantastic. This year, I'm in about not quite $600 yet. And what I do is instead of fundraising, I do main raising. I say, take the same amount of money you want to give to me for my campaign because you like my beliefs or ideas, and whether it's $25, $2,500, instead go and invest that in our community. Either donate it to a local not-for-profit or go shopping at a local business, a small business, and leave a note in the contact field and let them know. You know, almost every online order you place has an option for instructions or comments. Say, Tiffany Bond would not take my money, and she wanted me to invest in the community. She's running for U.S. Senate. Look her up. And through that, we're actually making the community better. I don't have to torture anybody with ads. And then the way people find me is this sort of serendipitous experience where they maybe didn't know who I am, but here is this person helping my small business and not torturing me with the awful ads, who really is committed to getting money out of politics and getting money back into our community.
You know, the way you describe that, this is a campaign that could not have made an impact in the same way it does 10, 20, 30 years ago, right? Like, things would be a lot different. But now with this new voting system in Maine and the power of the internet and social media, it could upend the way that a lot of campaigns are run especially if other kinds of candidates who are traditional candidates are kind of blind to what's happening.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, I'm not delusional. I know that my campaign maybe has a 10% chance of success, but I think we've all learned from 2020 and a couple of years before that 10% sometimes happens. You know, sometimes those statistically improbable things do well, and it's not a 1% chance. I think I actually have a decent chance as we get closer to the election, because there is so much money in this race. You know, this is projected to be about $100 million race, which is insane. And if you can contemplate what $100 million would do for either charities or small business, and especially in a poor state like Maine, that's huge.
And especially right now, considering how many people are out of work, how many people need stuff, like it's, yeah, you know, I think I've become accustomed to and used to what campaigns cost from seeing it in Pennsylvania and New Jersey from my perspective. But now looking at the needs that people have and seeing like, oh, the presidential race is going to cost $1 billion. Like, does it need to?
Right. Well, and here's the thing. If 10 people do Maine raising, and we have ranked choice voting, no harm, no foul. I didn't do any damage to the race. There's still big name candidates who are going to be in the race from the parties. And a few people got some sales. But say enough people listen to the message and say, I want to get money out of politics, and this is a generally reasonable person, and say 100,000 people do it. And that's not that weird in any given campaign collection quarter. You know, 100,000 donors to a statewide campaign is not unusual. But say 100,000 people, instead of donating, decide to go buy a custom-made jam or a new pair of earrings or something made in Maine by a small Maine business, that would fundamentally alter the election. And if I were to win on, say, $1,000, I don't know exactly how much I'm going to spend, but I'm in less than $600 now. My postage costs are going to go up a little bit with the pandemic, but let's just say I win on $1,000 or $2,000. When everybody else spent $100 million, that one race, that one win, if we concentrate energy from across the country, we'll change politics. If the coverage from Maine is $100 million went into a race and a quirky little independent won on $1,000, that says we don't actually need to worry as much about trying to elect people with gobs of money to get rid of Citizens United. Let's just elect people that don't take money, and then we can get it changed.
Well, and even if you affected the election by, like you said, like in the last race where, you know, you were the second choice vote for enough people that it made a difference, like that also will change kind of people's understanding of the system.
Yeah, I think there's two things that are really stopping us from having a functional democracy, and it's the amount of money in politics and the way that we are forced into discouraging participation in elections, right? So you change money out of politics by getting money out of politics. You don't just talk about it as a campaign message. Actually do it. But then you change the system by changing the system, right? Maine has had to have multiple referendum votes to say, no, we really do want ranked choice voting. And it's been predominantly not our political parties messaging it. It's been independents and the average citizens saying, we want this. We want to have more choices than two. It has been discouraged in part by both political parties because what it does is it takes a lot of the power out of the system and pushes it back to people. It means your single vote actually can make a huge difference. It means that when, you know, just this morning I had somebody online tell me to drop out, and I could say, no, you know what? You not only don't have to say that anymore, you really shouldn't say that anymore. You shouldn't tell people not to participate in politics.
Well, that's the point of my podcast. It's called You Should Run, not You Shouldn't Run. That's like...
Right. Well, why not? And ranked choice voting encourages you to say, look, there are, you know, both on primary for our parties have primaries here, the independents don't, we go straight to ballot. but both in the primary to say, you know, hey, I get that you might have a different candidate. Please look at how we compare and consider me for your number two. You don't have to be a jerk anymore, right? You don't have to show how everybody else is worse than you. You can actually be the better candidate by showing how the other candidates are great too. You just have a different perspective. And in doing that, you actually pick up their supporters, right? You increase your volunteer base. You actually make politics better and more inclusive by not being a jerk to the competition. And that's what we need.
I am, especially this week and through all this, I am very much pro less jerks. That
You know, it's funny, people always ask me to sum up my campaign in one sentence, and I mean federal policy cuts across so much. You really can't sum up all your policy goals in one sentence, but my best attempt is it's just not that hard to not be a jerk.
Right. I recently just wrote something on a personal blog about this, and I was like, a lot of, to me, and I know in my, I have a very privileged, straight, white, healthy male with a job and a family that's all healthy, and I understand that. But so many things that are happening in this country right now, whether it is the complicated issue of the, having not prepared for the COVID outbreak from the top, or it's, you know, these terrible racist incidents that have happened across the country, it's not that hard to do the easy choices. Like, it's to just not be a jerk, to not be a terrible person.
Well, and one of the funny things is, so I don't really fit into either the Democrat or Republican mold. We don't have people that are pointing out anymore that a lot of times the progressive goals and the moderate goals and the conservative goals are all the same, right? So, for example, if I'm looking at something minor, I'm going to pick a, this is a state-related thing, but I do a little bit of criminal defense work, and right now the state of Maine has a charge of drinking in public, and you can be arrested for this. And what it does is it criminalizes poverty, right? So you should dislike this charge and want the law changed if you're more progressive, because it's kind of inhumane, right? Somebody who's wealthy enough to drink in a restaurant can drink and walk out hosed, but that's not criminal. But if you have an open container, and even if you're sober, you know, because you don't have a place to live, because you can't afford a place to live, that's criminalized. But if you're a conservative and maybe you want to punish, still, it's not in your best interest for that, because it's expensive to put them in jail. It costs you more taxpayers to not teach somebody a lesson. I mean, somebody who's drinking in public, they're going to be charged with the same thing very often 30 to 60 days later, because they still don't have a home, and putting them in jail makes them much less likely to have a home. Yeah, I mean, a lot of those things overlap, even if they're maybe for different underlying reasons. A lot of the solutions are very similar, and we don't have people pointing a lot of that out, right? It is much less expensive to provide some very minimal housing and social services than it is to chronically jail somebody for a minor nonviolent infraction.
Yeah, and, you know, I look at people on social media, which, again, is one way for you to get your message out, and also terrible. There is a very sad, to me, and unfortunate amount of people who see any crime at all and think that a person should have to serve 10 years in prison or life in prison, like, just incredibly harsh sentences, when the cost of it, especially in relation to the crime, is just absurd.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've had plea deals be offered to clients that were 6 months in jail for stealing a $10 item. You know, because of habitual offender laws, every one of those thefts becomes a felony. And it is definitely the disposition of some people to say, well, they clearly didn't learn from a month in jail. Well, 6 months in jail, if they didn't learn from a month, is not going to teach them the difference. It's not a lesson, it's a desperation. They either don't have the resources and are finding ways to acquire them, you know, or they have a mental health issue that jail clearly doesn't solve.
And from looking at the COVID-19 pandemic and how many people in jails have been affected, how many people who are black and brown as a result of that and as a result of poverty aside from it and or in addition to, being in a prison right now could be a death sentence because of disease. And the cost of it is higher than people realize with just maintaining prisons, with the building, the staffing, etc. Hopefully people going through this, having been quarantined and basically imprisoned, not, you know, in their own home, hopefully that will change people's hearts and minds to understand, like, all right, we need to be a little bit more sensible here.
You know, I would love to agree with you, but I don't think that particularly changes people's hearts and minds. I mean, what changes people's hearts and minds a lot of the time is showing them that it's against their actual goals, right? So if you're trying to talk to somebody about criminalization that is pro-criminalization, you're not going to have them have some soul-searching epiphany by telling them that criminalization is inhumane. It very well may be. But if that person also really cares about how many tax dollars they pay, you know, telling them they have an extra $100 a year if they stopped criminalizing stupid things, a lot more effective of an argument. And, you know, I think that part of how we got to where we are in politics, there's a couple of things that have really gotten us to this bad place, you know, on top of voting systems and money. One of them is we have politicians that don't lead with the most compelling argument for their case with the person they're talking to, right? So telling me why I think something is important to me, that helps you know who I am. But telling somebody else why my point is important to them with something that's important to them, it's how you bring them to compromise. And the second quality is one we don't look for anymore in elected officials, unfortunately. The other thing that has really harmed us a lot is horse trading for essentially commercial value. The thing that I hear a lot in commercials is people saying that, you know, they're going to put Maine first, and not only does that have some terrifying white nationalist echoes, but it's not the job of the federal government, for example, to put Maine first. And if you go to Washington, D.C. and say, I'm here to put Maine first, you know, what you're signaling is I'm willing to trade off just about any ethical rules to bring back some pork home so that I can show that I brought jobs and I put Maine first. The job of Congress, it's to put a functional federal government first. The federal law, that's the scaffolding that all of our other law is built on. And if we're not doing regular maintenance and repair, we're gonna collapse in on ourselves. So,
well, and for those federal laws, whether it's the response to the pandemic, whether it is health care, whether it is criminal justice, as we've been discussing, doing the right thing on a federal level is putting your state first. They're not antithetical statements.
I don't think they are, but I think the message you're sending, if you're using that specific messaging, maybe is. You know, I think it's the difference between long-term and short-term, which is something that we've all forgotten.
Yeah.
Long-term, I think putting your state first is paying attention to that federal scaffolding. But, you know, like we've switched with value on companies to what the stock market thinks is your most recent quarterly report, not how you've done as a company over 100 years, you know, we've forgotten how to do any of the hard stuff. We've forgotten how to balance long-term and short-term results. We are in such a what happens next week or today world that we've forgotten that minor changes to something that maybe make it slightly less profitable or convenient now, but balance things down the road. You know, we just don't do those anymore, but we need to start. One of the things that I often tell people is, if you've spent 30 years ignoring your roof, you don't need a couple of shingles. You need a whole new roof and probably some support beams because you've got a leak that's created water damage. I mean, we keep punting on all of these important long-term issues like climate change, like how the short-term changes we make in our tax law have created some massive long-term damage. And we just keep punting and punting some because they're hard and they're controversial and they're easy to fundraise off of if you don't get anything done. And now we just have a complete cluster down in D.C.
Yeah, and of course your state is famous because, one, your politics are so much different than other states where you seem to have some very progressive residents, and then you've had some people like your former governor who, well, he was different, let's just put it that way. And then, you know, Susan Collins was, you know, people talk about her being a compromiser and all and everything, and maybe she was years ago, and now, you know, it's become a caricature where everyone kind of waits for the last minute to find out what her reasoning is going to be to quote unquote compromise, to just go along with what everyone kind of expected her to do. And it seems like you, like, main values do value compromise, and maybe that's missing right now.
Well, I think that there's a few things at play there. I mean, historically, Maine has some very reasonable Republicans.
Right.
So when you come to Maine and you say all Republicans are the devil, you're not going to do very well, right? And I think that that's a strategy nationally kind of taken is to say all Republicans are awful. But, you know, we've got Republicans like Olympia Snowe, who is still alive and engaged in the community, and she's widely beloved as a reasonable person. Margaret Chase Smith was kind of famously known for being reasonable. I think it's really easy to play the part of a reasonable, moderate person when the laws being proposed are reasonable and moderate. When the laws being proposed are much more extreme, I think it makes it very clear who is actually a reasonable moderate and who is not. And I think that it's made it very clear that right now, especially in the Senate, we don't really have any reasonable moderates. I think that Susan Collins likes to wear that jacket, but that's not maybe fundamentally who she is. If you look back at her votes historically, not even just the last few years, like historically, go back a decade or two, she's very much who she always has been. She's a very conservative person who likes to sell herself as a moderate. You know, in contrast with some actual moderates, and kind of famously her and some of the Republican moderates that are known for actually being moderates maybe have very frosty relationships. So,
right, Olympia Snowe was famous across the country because people, like, they didn't know how she would vote. She was obviously extremely caring about, you know, looking at the issue on either side.
Right, and so a lot of the, you know, the push, when you see people push into Maine that aren't from Maine and say, oh my gosh, all Republicans are horrible, like, those strategies aren't going to work here, because all Republicans aren't horrible, especially when you step down from a federal level. You'll see, especially out in these rural communities, I mean, your neighbors are just as likely as not to be Republican, probably more likely than if you're in the rural areas, or independent. A lot of them are conservative leaning. We actually have more independents here than either Republicans or Democrats, and I think a lot of people don't know how to reconcile that. You know, when you're across the country sort of told that independents are politically illegitimate and have no right to participate in politics, I mean, in Maine, we're the biggest voting group. So telling us we can't participate is sort of ridiculous. You know, we determine the outcome of every election here. So it's pretty awful to tell us that we don't have a role and we can't have our own candidates. So, you know, a lot of the Republicans that you see in Maine on an individual basis, they are not histrionic. They're not, you know, against human rights. They are your neighbor who will shovel your driveway if you've had a bad week or your snowblower gave out. I mean, they're a part of our community. And so to treat them like they're some sort of alien invading force, it's not going to give you the results you want. Our Democrats here are a lot more moderate a lot of the time than we see, and actually our independents tend to have the most moxie. So it's weird to see the national politics try and project themselves on main races. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things I noticed in 2018 is, you know, a Democrat ended up winning the race, but the people who supported him and got him in office actually agreed more with me on most of the policy than they did with him. And he was actually the Democrat that not only split his vote on impeachment, but sort of spoon-fed the federal Republicans with their reasoning for why he should be acquitted. So that really, you know, bothered me as somebody who said, look, I just don't tolerate corruption. Corruption is not acceptable. I don't care what your political party is. You know, if you're running a con on the American people, you don't belong in office.
Right.
Period. You know, I don't... And so I get a lot of grief sometimes for both siderisms, but it's not. It's that there's a minimum threshold, and you have to meet that threshold. When you get above that threshold, you know, we'll talk about where objectively you're better or worse. But if you don't meet that threshold, it doesn't matter what your party is. You just have no business in public life.
So that's a good background about Maine, about what you're running for and what, like, what your purpose is. The podcast, as we discussed, is called You Should Run. Having done this and been involved, not just now, but more than once now, why should more people run, and then maybe especially some unconventional candidates or unconventional campaigns, why should more people run for office in 2020 and 2021 and beyond?
Well, so our system is broken, and the only way you're going to change it is by doing different things and taking risks, and that is not going to come from the system that we have now, and it's not going to come from a lot of candidates that have existed in the past. It's going to come from people who say, look, I'm just an average person. You know, I push back a lot against the system with an average middle-class to poor person should be able to run for office without having to risk their financial security and without having to enlist a multi-million dollar team, right? Any office in our country, with the possible exception of president, just because you do have to travel a lot for that particular role, we've got a very large country, any person should be able to run for any level office, period. Mm-hmm. And if you are just an average suburban mom, I mean, I drive a minivan, I have two kids, I have one bathroom, I live in a very middle class house, I'm still working full time. And we have to have more people that step forward and say, it's bull. It is absolute bull to say you need millions of dollars to win these races, and it's just not true. We make a collective choice right now to make that true, but we can make a collective choice to make something else true. And that means running in unconventional ways. That means pushing back on media when they fail to cover candidates. One of the things I discovered in 2018, and I can't believe I made it to my 40s without knowing this, is I always assumed that they covered all of the viable candidates, and viable was anybody who wasn't spouting nutty conspiracy theories, right? What I discovered is they only cover you if you have millions of dollars, and that you only have millions of dollars if they cover you. And it's this horrible feedback loop. Like, even just the sheer act of polling only two candidates and not polling everybody else, you know, if the person who answers the phone doesn't know who that other candidate is, they're going to go look them up. That's free ad right there to go look somebody up. That's free media. So if we're not pushing back on media, if we're not pushing back on polls, if we're not saying, look, there are better ways to do this, we're never going to change, and we're going to be trapped here. So all it takes is a couple of people to win races in very unconventional ways or new ways or ways that challenge the system to be able to say quite legitimately, that's just not true. You don't need money and to already be a part of this awful machine we have to win. It's not true. If I win this race, if I take that 10% shot and I win this race on $1,000 or $2,000, just that one win will say, you know what, politics, you projected everything you thought was true on this race, and it wasn't. We can do it different. And I would encourage anybody to try and do it different. I would encourage anybody to find ways to run that invest in your community. And by all means, steal Maine raising. You know, go out, make it, you know, insert your jurisdiction here raising, and tell people, don't give me money. Tell people, let's put it in our communities. Let's make campaign season something to look forward to, not something to hide from or be grossed out by. Like, we don't have to have what we have now. We can have better.
Awesome. I really appreciate you. You're trying to make it better. I think we need to do better on everything right now, especially. So any efforts to do that is a plus. Before we go, if people want to learn more about you, where should they go? How should they follow you?
Sure. I'm easiest to reach on Twitter at TiffanyBond.com. Maine has a lot of digital access issues. So, you know, platforms like Instagram, I'm on there, but it's just hard to find the data necessary to upload photos. And Facebook is maybe not very concerned with privacy or democracy, so I'm seldom on that platform. I also have a website. It's Bond, B-O-N-D, the number 4, and then .me. Come find me. Look me up. Let's come up with things that make things better. If it's not my idea, I'm happy to incorporate other ideas, too. Our government is an active, living thing. It is a collaboration, and we should be doing it together.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And people, everyone, everywhere, please look into Tiffany, follow what she's doing, and hopefully you'll be inspired to make your own way to run for office as well. Thank you, Tiffany, and best of health and luck up in Maine.
Thank you so much for having me.